The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I think this is my third time at the Free Library, and it only gets better. I'm on the middle of my book tour, and it occurred to me when I was coming here that the first stop on my book tour was the 92nd Street Y in New York, which is it's the Jewish Y. And then I went to L.A., and I did an evening at that synagogue on Wilshire, that new fancy one. And then I went to San Francisco, and I did the JCC. And then I went to Washington, and I did the synagogue at 6th and I. I think you can see where I'm going with this. Of course, this explains why I managed to come tonight, because it's Shabbat. It's the one night of the week that I'm free to talk to non-Jewish audiences. Very glad that worked out. I'm not going to talk about my book tonight, or at least I'm not going to tell you a story from my book, because I figured most of you are going to buy the book. Why would I ruin the experience for you? So I thought I would talk about a story that is related, bears directly on one of the big themes of the book. And one of the big themes of the book is, why do underdogs fight? Why do people who are outgunned and outmanned and overmatched continue to keep on fighting against much larger and stronger opponents? Right? What fuels that kind of resistance? And so I thought what I'd do is tell a story about someone who I think reflects on this question in a very important way. The story is about a woman named Alva Smith, who was one of the most important figures in the suffragette movement in the early part of the 20th century. And she's interesting because if you look at Alva Smith's life, there is very little in her life that would suggest or portend to a life of radicalism. She's the most unlikely radical imaginable. And if we understand how she came to take up the position of radicalism, I think we'll get some insight into this crucial question of why it is that people choose to battle giants. So Alva Smith actually has three names. Alva Belmont is the name that she dies with. Alva Vandermilt is the name that she became famous with. And Alva Smith is the name she was born with. She was the daughter of a semi-prosperous businessman. She grew up in Mobile, Alabama, and then her family moved to New York City. And she was, even from a very young age, a piece of work. She was domineering, dictatorial, bossy, bad-tempered, egomaniacal. She was a handful. She picked fights. She, even from the youngest age, she was this little kind of fireplug with a face that a friend of hers, trying to be nice, said resembled a Pekingese. But I think actually it'd be more accurate to say that she looked a lot like a pit bull. She was that, you know, you have some sense of what. She was one of these indomitable people who walks into a room and takes it over. And so there she is in New York, and she has grand ambitions for herself at a very young age. And she decides the only way she's going to make her mark on the world is if she has access to some kind of money, right? And so she doesn't have any herself, and so she casts her eye across New York society and settles on a young man named Willie Vanderbilt, who was a charming, handsome playboy who just happened to be the grandson of the richest man in the world. And so she marries him. And she bears him a daughter named Consuelo and two sons. And then she sets about on a course to become the greatest conspicuous consumer in the history of conspicuous consumption. And I feel like all of us who've lived through the last 15 years realize what an extraordinary accomplishment that is. The first thing she does is she buys 800 acres on Long Island and instructs the greatest architects of the time to build her something in shingles overlooking the bay. And then she buys the block at the corner of 52nd and 5th and builds a French-style chateau, which costs, in $1890, $3 million, which is a couple of $100 million in today's money. And to give you a sense of what this chateau was like, I'm just going to read to you an account of it from one of the many books that have been written about Alva Vanderbilt's real estate portfolio, all of which are exercises in what might be called real estate pornography. So here's the description of her house. Everything was everywhere. Walls of red African marble, of stamped leather, walls hung with blue silk brocade, with red velvet embroidered with leaves, flowers, and butterflies, enriched with cut crystal and precious stones. Ceilings of mahogany, of brass, of colored glass, of bamboo, wainscoting of rosewood inlaid with mother of pearl and brass, ebony inlaid with ivory, polished ebony inlaid with satinwood, and Grecian, Oriental, Elizabethan, English, Renaissance, French, and Victorian touches. In crowded rooms bursting with bronze, stained glass, marble, and mosaics. Then she decides she wants a yacht, and not just any yacht. The biggest yacht of all time, 285 feet, which she christens the Alva. What's the matter with you guys? Then she decides if she wants a country cottage, she builds one in Newport, Rhode Island, and I won't bother to go into a description of it except to say that the construction of this cottage required first the construction of a special harbor in Newport, big enough to handle the 500,000 cubic feet of white Italian marble she was importing just for the facade. So now she has the country house, the city house, the country cottage, the yacht, and her attention turns to her daughter, Consuelo. And Consuelo is this shy girl, painfully shy, who has been raised in the strictest of fashion by her mother. She is required to speak only French to her parents. On Friday nights, she must recite a poem in German from memory in front of her mother. She has to wear a corset at all times with, you know, one of those steel rods in the back. She, if she made the slightest misstep in public, she would be immediately ridiculed and corrected by her mother. And as Consuelo enters adolescence, Alva gets the idea that what she really wants to do is to marry her daughter off to some English aristocrat. Now, this is not an original idea at that time. In this era of American life, it was the fashion for the wealthy daughters of American robber barons to be married off to the penurious sons of English aristocrats. In fact, they had a name for the practice. It was called cash for class. But Consuelo somewhat typically decides that she only wants the very, very best for her daughter. And her eye falls on Charles Richard John Spencer Churchill, otherwise known as Sonny, who was the 9th Duke of Marlborough, the lineal ancestor of Princess Di and the first cousin of Winston Churchill and the heir to Blenheim Palace, then as now one of the largest private homes in the world, the main buildings of which encompass 7 acres and made Alva's chateau on the corner of 57 and 5th look like some kind of ranch-style bungalow. But Alva does her homework and discovers that Blenheim Palace is falling down and Sonny Churchill hasn't got the funds to fix it up, and she realizes, aha, there is my opportunity. Now, there's two problems with this idea. The first is that Sonny is not, in fact, Sonny. He is a perfectly miserable sod, as the English would say. And to give you some sense of what Sonny was like, his second wife, Emily Deacon, used to sleep with a revolver by her pillow in case her husband should come to her in the middle of the night. The second problem with this idea is that Consuelo is madly in love with someone else, a young man named Winthrop Rutherford, otherwise known as Wintry, the scion of a fabulous New York family, a young, handsome, dashing man, a great athlete, a fabulous dancer. And on Consuelo's 18th birthday, she gets a single rose in the mail with no note attached, and she knows it's from Wintry. And not long after that, she goes for a bicycle ride with Wintry, and her mother, Alva, of course, is coming along as chaperone. And as they approach a corner in the road, Wintry and Consuelo look at each other and speed up ahead. And as they turn the corner and out of sight of Alva, Wintry turns to Consuelo and he proposes to her. And she says, absolutely. And Alva, of course, realizes something is up and tries to catch up as fast as her little legs can carry her. And she catches up and she looks at her daughter and she looks at Wintry and she realizes what just happened. And so she whisks her daughter away the next day to Paris. And Wintry sends letter after letter, love letter to his beloved. And each one of those letters is intercepted by Alva. And then Wintry gets on a boat and goes to Paris to try and meet her. And Alva bars the door to Wintry. And then Alva takes Consuelo to the cottage in Newport and locks her up like Rapunzel in the castle. And Wintry comes to try to see her. And once again, he can't get there. And finally, Consuelo has had enough. And she marches up the big marble staircase to her mother's bedroom, grand bedroom, replete with cherubs holding shields emblazoned with the letter A. And she turns to her mother and she says, "You can't do this to me. I'm in love with this man. I have a right to marry the man I choose." And her mother turns to her in a kind of cold rage and says, "Absolutely not. You're going to be a duchess. Do you know what that means?" And Consuelo just simmers and doesn't say a word and looks at her mother with a kind of defiance. At that point, Alva just turns into a rage, throws, because no one ever defies her. She's Alva Vanderbilt, and she starts to scream at her daughter and to call Wintry every name under the sun. And Consuelo stands there and takes it all in and realizes there's no point. There's no way she can defy her mother. She has to give up on this man she loves. And so on November 6, 1895, New York sees the grandest wedding in its history. The daughter of one of the richest men in the country marries one of the grandest aristocrats in all of England at St. Thomas's Church on Fifth Avenue. And Alva hires 80 decorators just to work on the church sanctuary, right? And she marches up the aisle with her two young sons on either side of her, wearing this extraordinary blue satin dress with a border of Russian sable. And outside, there are every reporter in the country is there taking photographs, and the crowds are thronging up, you know, held back by police officers, and the streets are lined with these grand carriages. And Alva stands at the front of the church, proudly awaiting her daughter. And she waits, and she waits, first 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then 15 minutes. Consuelo doesn't show up. Why not? Because she's at home weeping inconsolably into the arms of her father. Finally, she pulls herself together, and all of the maids in attendance clean her up, and she gets in the carriage and she goes to the church, and the minister pronounces them man and wife. And Alva immediately whisks her daughter and her son-in-law into a room behind the sanctuary, and the prenup is signed. And Sonny gets $1 million up front and a guarantee of $100,000 a year for life. And he gets into a carriage with his bride, and they drive off down Fifth Avenue. And Sonny turns to Consuelo and says, "I think you should know that I don't love you and I will never love you. Your responsibility is to fix up the castle and bear me an heir." Right? And standing on the steps of the church is Alva. There she is, and a tear comes to her eye as she watches the carriage recede down Fifth Avenue. It's the greatest moment of her life, right? The little girl from Mobile, Alabama, is now the mother of a duchess. It is the fulfillment of all of her dreams, or so she thinks, because things are about to get a little complicated. Now, I said earlier that I think of Alva as a very unlikely radical, and I think you can see why. It's not typically the case that very, very wealthy people with lots of homes and fancy clothes turn into radicals. It would be like one of the Kardashian sisters joining the Occupy movement. It's a little unlikely, I think we would all agree. So how do we account for this? What happened to Alva to cause this transformation? Well, I think the best way to answer that is to take a step back and to think a little bit about, in general, about the question of why it is that people choose to rebel against authority. Well, there's a number of answers to that. One of the leading theories for many years has been a simple one, that people choose to break the law or rebel against authority or disobey when the costs of disobedience are lower than the benefits, right? We weigh in our minds whether it's worth it. And if it makes more sense to fight back than it does to succumb, we fight back. This is what's called deterrence theory. And it seems like common sense. You know, the famous example of deterrence theory is in 1970, the police in Montreal went on strike for 19 hours. And in that 19-hour period, Montreal descended into bedlam. Why? Because the costs of disobedience were zero. And people started robbing banks, and there were gun battles in the streets. I mean, this is Canada that we're talking about. I didn't even know people had guns in Canada. The problem with this idea, though, is that there are all kinds of cases where deterrence theory does not explain our behavior. So a simple one would be look at people, whether the decision people make about whether to pay their taxes. That's the most common example of law-abiding behavior that anyone in the developed world has to go through. Well, there are huge differences from one country to the next in how honest people are on tax day, right? If you go to Greece or Italy, the cheating on tax day is rampant. The size of the underground economy in those countries is enormous. Whereas if you come to a country like this, there's very little cheating on taxes. In fact, this is probably Americans, we are more honest on tax day than anyone else in the world, right? Now, so the question is, if deterrence theory works, that would suggest that the penalties for cheating on your taxes must be greater here than in Greece or Italy, right? The costs of breaking the law must be greater in this country if we're so well behaved on tax day. Well, is that the case? No, it's not. In fact, the penalties for cheating on your taxes are lower here than anywhere else. Basically, we don't really have penalties. I mean, the IRS, if you don't pay your taxes and they find out, will basically just tell you to pay them a small penalty. They rarely put anyone in jail for it. And the audit rates in this country are a fraction of what they are in other countries. If you cheat on your taxes, you probably won't get caught. Right? Now, I don't mean for any of you to take that to heart. But the fact is that tax-paying behavior in this country does not ally with the deterrence theory, right? It doesn't make any sense. Here's another example. If deterrence theory really works, then countries or jurisdictions that dramatically increase their penalties for breaking the law should see a decline in crime, right? So let's look at the best example, and that's California. 20 years ago, California enacted the most dramatic increase in the severity of criminal penalties that we have seen almost anywhere in the Western world over the last 100 years, right? Three strikes. The three strikes law was an unbelievable increase in the severity. So what happened after they did that? If deterrence theory is correct, crime should have plunged in California after that law was passed. Did it? Well, it did, but then it also plunged at the same time in every other state in the union, even those who didn't change their laws at all. And when, in subsequent years, as we have looked closer and closer at the California experience, what we've discovered is that no one really can figure out what happened in California. Some people say that crime went down a little bit. Some people say that nothing happened. And other people say, actually, crime is higher today than it would have been if they hadn't passed that law in California. Once again, the legitimacy theory doesn't seem to explain why people do or don't obey the law. So in response to these problems with deterrence theory, a bunch of people have come forward and said, you know what, the real issue is not that. It's not the costs and benefits of breaking the law. It's really how laws are enacted. And a group of scholars led by a guy named Tom Tyler have said, what really matters is whether people perceive the laws that they that govern them to be legitimate. And by legitimate, we mean three things. One is that people will obey the law when they feel like they are treated with respect, when they feel that if they speak up, they'll be heard. Do they have a right to speak up? And will someone listen when they do? People will perceive a law to be legitimate when they feel like it's fair. Is there one law for me and one law for you, or are we all being treated roughly the same, right? And they also will obey a law when they and see it as legitimate, when they feel like it's consistent. Is it going to change dramatically tomorrow, right? So with these examples in mind, think back to the puzzle of why Americans pay their taxes. Well, we pay our taxes not because there are huge penalties associated with cheating. We pay our taxes because we believe the American system is legitimate, right? Now, I know we grumble about it all the time, but the truth of the matter is, if you stand up and complain about your taxes, will you be heard? Of course you'll be heard. There's an entire party in the American political system devoted to listening to people grumbling about their taxes, right? Is the tax system fair? Well, it's not perfect, but it's pretty fair. I mean, there isn't a whole different set of rules for a certain kind of people, except if you're a hedge fund guy, but that's a separate matter. But the amount of unfairness in our system is a fraction of the unfairness in other systems around the world. And is our system consistent? Yes, it is, right? We don't make arbitrary changes willy-nilly from one year to the next. No, we make changes in our tax code after a lot of discussion, right? We know what's happening. This isn't some kind of strange, unknowable system. Now, compare that to Greece. Greece fails on all three counts. You can't speak up in that system. No, it's totally corrupt. People are cutting special deals. It changes from one year to the next. It treats one class of citizens completely different from another class of citizens. If our system looked like Greece's, we wouldn't pay our taxes either. Right? Completely illegitimate. And why didn't three strikes have a discernible effect on the crime rate in California? Because maybe if you lock up everyone in sight, which is what California did, maybe people from those communities come to think of the system as illegitimate. Like, let's not forget, California, in the 10 years after three strikes was passed, their prison population doubled. They ended up with seven, on a per capita basis, seven times as many people in prison as Canada or Western Europe. That's an astonishing number, right? Do you think that the people from those communities that saw essentially an entire cohort of black men picked up and shipped off to prison in the space of 5 years, do you think that they perceive the system as legitimate? Do you think they thought they could speak up and be heard? Do you think they thought that there was a same set of rules was governing white America as was governing their community? Do you think they saw the system as being consistent and trustworthy as opposed to arbitrary? Of course not. So what happens in situations where people perceive the system as illegitimate? They rebel, right? They get angry. They feel under no compulsion to obey the law. Right? Nothing serves as a bigger engine of defiance than the condition of feeling that you're under some kind of disrespectful, untrustworthy, arbitrary system. Which brings us back to Alva. Because she lived in a society that did not treat her with any legitimacy. Now, that seems hard to believe, because here we have this insanely rich woman running around building these castles. It seems like she would have no complaint in the world, right? But the truth is, she lived in a world that was incredibly narrow and oppressive. Women of her class and station were expected to stay at home and keep their mouth shut. They weren't allowed to vote. They couldn't have jobs. They couldn't go to college. They couldn't participate in any meaningful way in the public life of the society of which they were a part. They were told to stay at home, take care of the children and the servants, and put on dinner parties, right? The men, meanwhile, could do whatever they wanted. Go to college, start businesses, have meaningful jobs, run for public office. Under the laws of that time, a man could divorce a woman simply by alleging infidelity. For a woman to divorce a man, she had to prove infidelity and physical cruelty. One set of rules for women, one set for men. The men in that circle that she was a part of could indulge every whim they wanted. They would get on the J.P. Morgan's yacht and go out to sea and fill the yacht with call girls. And they would have mistresses in apartments in town with whom they openly consorted. Meanwhile, the women, they had to stay home and keep up respectable appearances. And Willie Vanderbilt, Alva's husband, was no exception. He was this spoiled playboy, right? He didn't work for a living. He inherited this gigantic fortune, and he was handsome and charming, and he had one affair after another, openly in front of all the people in their social circle. Meanwhile, Alva was required to keep her mouth shut and be the dutiful hostess. You know, she looked from the outside like she was a woman in command of her world, but in fact, she was desperately unhappy. And she would later describe the years leading up to Consuelo's wedding as the worst of her life. And she and Willie had begun to argue. She'd begun to feel increasingly trapped and dissatisfied. And she meets a man, Oliver Belmont, with whom she falls in love, but she can't have an affair with him. There's no way a woman of her situation and standing could possibly do what all the men were doing. And she finally, in an attempt to save her marriage, she turns to Willie and she says, "Can we take a family vacation?" And so they go off as a family to Paris. But it's a complete disaster, because the minute they get to Paris, Willie starts an affair not just with her best friend, but also with this prostitute, high-class prostitute in Paris called Nellie Neustrater, and runs around Paris with these two women, completely humiliating Alva. And she feels she has no choice. And so she kicks him out. She says, "That's it," right? And everyone in her life says, "You can't do that." The lawyer with whom she tries to file divorce papers against her husband says, "No, don't you, won't do it for her." Says that you're being ridiculous, right? All of her friends are up in arms. The tabloids, can you imagine? They descend on her. Here we have one of the wealthiest couples in all of America are having this very, very public falling out. I mean, you can't imagine what a press circus it is. And she comes out of the church in Newport, where she has been attending her entire adult life, and all these people who she considers her friends turn their back on her. They won't talk to her. They pretend she doesn't exist. But she feels she has no choice, right? Later in her life, when she writes her memoirs, she writes this incredibly poignant passage about what it was like to be a woman in that era. And she says, "It was considered religious, dignified, and correct for the wife to withdraw into the shadows while her husband paid the family respects to the sunshine. A woman was supposed to get her sunlight by proxy through her husband." And that phrase, "sunlight by proxy," is so heartbreaking. And I think it helps to put some of Alva's behavior in perspective. You know, here we have this brilliant, ambitious, driven woman. And in today's world, she would be an entrepreneur. She would have started her own company. She would be running something. She'd be running for public office, right? She would be taking on the world on a grand scale. But every one of those avenues is denied to her. And what's the only thing she can do? Build houses. That's all they'll let her do, right? So what does she do? Build houses, right? On the grandest, most ambitious scale she can. Why? Because she has no other outlet for her extraordinary energies and extraordinary creativity and intelligence. She's frustrated. Society in which she lives won't give her a chance to do anything meaningful. I think this also makes sense of her seemingly inexcusable behavior around her daughter and her daughter's marriage. You know, her daughter may be in love with Winthrop Rutherford, but Wintry Rutherford, it should be remembered, was 33 at the time that Consuelo was 18. He was this handsome man from a family that was described by one of the tabloids of that era as best known for wearing expensive clothing. He's a dilettante. He plays golf and polo at the Newport Country Club all day long, right? And when she looks at him, she sees just another version of her own useless husband. Some guy, this kind of idle, decadent philanderer who's going to condemn her daughter to a lifetime of misery. By contrast, what does the Duke of Marlborough offer? Well, he's a miserable sod, sure, but he's a miserable sod in another country, right? In a place where she can be called a duchess and have real standing in society and stand up and be listened to when she wants to speak and have a place in the public affairs of that world and live in a society that is free from the kind of dreadful constraints of New York high society. Now, to us that sounds like a dreadfully cynical calculation because Consuelo was genuinely in love with Wintry. And we think that love ought to be the basis for marriage. But 100 years ago, in the society of which Alva was a part, love seemed to her like an impossible luxury, right? Consuelo was her great hope, and she was not going to let her daughter squander her life in the same way she felt her own life had been squandered. So in that moment when Consuelo and Sonny are pulling away in the carriage and this tear comes to Alva's eye, it's not a tear of joy, right? This is an incredibly tragic moment for her. This is a woman who has had to alienate her own beloved daughter in order to save her. This is a woman who is trapped in the most horrible and loveless and benighted of marriages. This is a woman who has witnessed the society of which she's a part turn against her. Why? Because she dared to stand up to this jerk that she was married to. She's a woman who is living a life of indescribable hell. But she doesn't turn back or back down. And why not? Because she does not perceive the authority of those who shun her as legitimate. They haven't given her standing. They haven't allowed her to speak up about what has gone wrong. They haven't treated her fairly. The law that governs her and tells her what she should and shouldn't do is arbitrary, right? It's not trustworthy. You know, she's supposed to stay at home and be quiet while her husband runs around town with a French prostitute. At that moment when Alva is in that position of indescribable hell, she's undergoing the moment that all radicals undergo. She's angry. Now, one of the things that I try and answer in my book, David and Goliath, is why it is that people in positions of power fail to understand the significance of anger. Why don't we understand just what a powerful emotion it is for people who appear to be on the outside and appear to have no obvious resources to hold in their hearts? I have a chapter in the book about the troubles in Northern Ireland, and I went and spent a good portion of one summer in Belfast, not something that I would recommend that anyone do. But that summer I went to a meeting that was held in a neighborhood called Ballymurphy, a Catholic neighborhood of Belfast, and it was to commemorate the 30th anniversary of what's called the Ballymurphy Massacre, when British troops opened fire on a group of Catholic civilians, killing several of them. And, you know, in England, no one thinks about the Ballymurphy Massacre anymore. It was 30 years ago. They've moved on, right? They're not dwelling on it, and they're worried about other things, and they think of it as something that happened in the past. But if you stood in that auditorium as I did, just like this, with as many people as this, as they were talking about events that happened 3 decades ago, you would have thought that the shooting had happened yesterday. The emotions were that raw. People were collapsing in tears and crying out in their grief and being pulled screaming from the room. And it made me realize that long after we've forgotten the consequences of our actions, the people who have been oppressed and abused continue to nurse their rage and their anger in their own hearts. Right? Made me think about what people think in Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan. You know, we're going to move on from those conflicts, and we're going to forget about them, and we're going to think it's all done and dusted, but that's a mistake. If the people who we were fighting against do not perceive our authority as legitimate, they will carry anger in their hearts for generations, and we will bear the consequences of that. And that was exactly the situation with Alva. No one around her understood the consequences of her anger. No one understood what it meant to have a ticking time bomb in their midst, right? Who was walking around with a grievance, because the consequences would be grave. She, in the greatest of ironies, the person who sets off the ticking time bomb, that is Alva, is her daughter Consuelo. In the years after her marriage to Sonny, Consuelo is transformed. She bears him two sons, who she would thereafter refer to as an heir and a spare. And then she leaves him. Of course she does. And when she leaves him, she is so respected by her peers in English society, and she handles herself with such grace, and everyone knows what a complete jerk her husband is, that London society rallies around her and lifts her up, and she turns into one of the leading moral voices of her generation. She becomes an advocate for genuine social justice and change in Victorian England. And in 1908, she returns to New York for the first time, this suddenly tall and beautiful, charismatic woman. And she gives a famous speech towards all of the assembled society ladies of New York at the Waldorf Astoria. And what she has discovered when her time in England is that England is a very different place than America. England is a place where women really could stand up and speak out. England is a place where a woman like her could play a real role in public society. And what Consuelo does in her speech to all of these assembled society ladies is to chastise them and to say, you're wasting your life. You're slaves to your husbands. You have all kinds of resources and an opportunity to make a difference, and you're not taking it, right? You're a disgrace. And sitting in the front row of the audience is Alva. And you can imagine how she feels, right? 15 years ago, she had sent her daughter off in tears, right? Taking her away from the only man she had ever loved, because she felt that was the only way to save her. And now her daughter is back in New York, and what's happened? Her daughter has been saved. And Alva and Consuelo have a talk afterwards, after the speech is over, and Consuelo turns to her mother and says, you know, in spite of everything, I'm glad I married an Englishman. And you can imagine, it's like a weight has been lifted off Alva's back, and all of the guilt that she's been carrying around with her for so long is absolved. And not long after that, Alva accepts an invitation to hear a speech on the suffragette movement. And women, of course, in America and around the world in those years, couldn't vote. They had been denied that most basic of human rights. In that period in America, only 4 American states were women given limited voting rights, Wyoming and Idaho and Colorado. But the movement for nationwide voting rights for women had been stalled. It was going nowhere. And Alva listens to this speech, and she realizes this is the only way to bring legitimacy to women, that only by winning the vote can we create a system in America that gives women voice, that treats them fairly, and treats them without trustworthy and non-arbitrary manner. And she looks at the state of the suffragette movement, and she realizes that it's in disarray. They've got no drive, they've got no strategy, they've got no energy, they've got no resources, no money. And all of those things are things that Alva has in spades. So what does she do? Well, she does the same thing she's done her entire life. She barges in and takes over. And she's the headquarters of the suffragette movement in that era was in Warren, Ohio. And Alva hears this and rolls her eyes and says, Are you kidding me? Warren, Ohio, and she moves it into a building she buys on Fifth Avenue in New York. And then she says, my country cottage in Newport, Rhode Island, that's going to be our convention headquarters. And they start to have the meetings of the national suffragette movement amidst the grandeur of Alva's house, while her fancy neighbors, by the way, look on with outrage. And when a group of female immigrant garment workers go on strike in protest against the appalling conditions under which they work and start a march through downtown Manhattan, who's at the front of the march? Alva is. And when they get arrested and are being held and by a judge in some prison in downtown New York, who stands in the courtroom all night long eyeballing the judge until he lets them free? Alva does. And who stands up and says, wait a minute, the black women of America belong in this movement, right? Until that point, there had been a group of black suffragettes, but they had been off on their own because black and white didn't mix. But Alva said, what do you mean? They're women just like us. They belong with us. And when the movement was perceived by some as moving too quickly, and many suffragettes stood up and said, you know what, if we continue to be this aggressive, we're going to start antagonizing men. Alva stands up and says, wait a minute, men don't worry about antagonizing men. Why should we? And then the First World War starts, and lots of suffragettes say, this is no time for us to be pushing for this kind of radical reform. We should take down the picketers outside the White House. And Alva stands up and says, over my dead body, this is exactly the time we should be pushing for this kind of radical reform. And she made sure the pickets stayed up there until the end of the war. And what happened to Alva in this period? Well, you can imagine. She was roundly denounced and ostracized and pushed out of polite society. She was seen as this domineering, dictatorial, egomaniacal woman who had barged into an organization and led it on some radical path. But you know the other thing that happened? On August 18th, 1920, the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution was passed, giving women, for the first time in American history, the right to vote. And the lesson of Alva's great victory is as pertinent today as it was 100 years ago. And that is that if you deny people legitimacy, they will one day, by one means or another, come back and defeat you. One last thing. Alva dies in the spring of 1933 from a stroke, and her funeral is held at St. Thomas's Church on Fifth Avenue, the same church where her daughter was married so many years ago. And everyone shows up. I mean, the limousines line the streets, and the reporters from every newspaper in the country come up, and the crowds throng and are held back by police. And the 20 of the most prominent feminists in the country serve as her pallbearers, and at her service, the crowd sings three hymns. The first is a famous hymn by Harriet Beecher Stowe. The second is the suffragette battle song, The March of the Women. And the third is a hymn composed by Alva herself, which is the greatest of all tributes to this remarkable and extraordinary woman. And the hymn is all about how when Alva gets to heaven, she'll be damned if she's going to let a man, St. Peter, stand in judgment of her. And it begins, no waiting at the gates of paradise, no tribunal of men to judge. The watchers of the tower proclaim a daughter of the king. Thank you. I think we have some time for questions. I've forgotten how they work, but I can repeat the question so people can hear.
Where is the greatest illegitimacy in the world
Now? Where in the world do you see the greatest illegitimacy right now?
In so many places, large and small. In any country where you know, look at the way women are treated in many parts of the Middle East. Look at the way in this country we continue to treat illegal immigrants or other groups or, you know, I could go on and on and on. I think that even within, we don't even have to look on a global level. We could go into numerous companies and you could see how underlings are treated by their superiors. I think this is sort of a lesson for all of us that to be fair and impartial and consistent is the obligation of those in power. Just because you have all of the resources doesn't mean you can behave as you wish, right? You have it's the old cliche, with power comes responsibility. And we need to be reminded of that every day because every day we forget it when we gain power. Any other? I realize I'm sounding I'm sounding like I'm on my war horse. I don't mean sound so grim and forbidding, but
in this country, income inequality is growing at a rapid rate, and we've recently had a demonstration that most of us don't think our government representatives are fair and consistent in representing us. And all of that would seem to speak by legitimacy theory that we have rebellion at our backs. Is that what you see?
I have to say that I am, you know, that I guess I'll answer it this way, that if you read historical accounts of the last period in American history where we had income inequality as great as we have now, which is really Alva's generation, right? She was a big part of it. What is amazing to learn is how close this country came to massive social unrest. I don't want to say revolution, that's too far, but we came this close to having a real breakdown in social order. We have forgotten that now. And so it is a very perilous position to have this kind of gap between rich and poor. It's not sustainable. We were saved last time by the Depression and by a very, very courageous man named FDR. And I hope we have a similar, I don't hope we have a depression again, but I hope we have a similar politician of courage who can sort of right the ship and close that gap so that we have a chance to have a fresh start at our system. Way in the back. I feel we can hear you, though.
I'm trying.
We've given you voice.
Absolutely. You're well known for weaving together many, many disparate facts and theories. So excluding when you hone in on your research for your books, what's your daily kind of info feed, your sources? What do you read or listen to? Like, what's your world like?
Oh, wow. I feel I'm giving away trade secrets at this point. Shouldn't I? It's like Colonel Sanders telling you about the herbs and spices. Nothing exciting happens. There's a lot of kind of aimless drifting around Lower Manhattan. There's a lot of time spent wandering through libraries, hoping to stumble on something amazing, which is why I'm a self-professed library nerd. Because that's what happens in libraries. Thank you. There's a lot of talking, listening to people. You know, almost everyone has an interesting story to tell, but what people don't realize, what none of us, I don't mean all of us have interesting stories to tell, but what we don't know is which of our stories are interesting, right? Because we have no perspective on it. And one of the things that you learn to do if you're a journalist is probe, ask questions until you stumble on what's interesting. If I might give you a little family example of this. So my father waited until about a year and a half ago to tell me the following story. This is in proof of the proposition that people do not know what their most interesting stories are. Okay, so Exhibit A, Graham Gladwell, tells me the following story. It's quite a long story. You'll have to bear with me. My father marries my mother in 1958. My mother's Jamaican. My father is English. Mildly radical act for that time. They move back to Jamaica. He's teaching at the University of West Indies. And he needs to get access to a library book for his research, a mathematical text. It's not in the library at the University of West Indies. He canvasses the United States and discovers it is in the library of Georgia Tech. He writes Georgia Tech, says, "Can I use your library?" They say, "Yes." But then only later does he realize that the permission was granted too hastily. And Georgia Tech is then sent into a panic because, of course, it's 1959 and Georgia Tech is a segregated institution. And they realize to their horror that they've just granted permission to use their library to someone who teaches at the University of West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica. And their only thought is, oh God, what if he's black? So this starts this frantic attempt by the administration of Georgia Tech to discover whether, in fact, my father is black. Because it's not like, you know, can't tell from his name. There's not like, you can't go on the internet back then and image Google Graham Gladwell. So they start calling around America, sending letters, and he's in Jamaica. It's hard. You can't call Kingston, Jamaica even in that time. So panic sets in. Finally, the day before my father is set to leave for this odyssey, because it was an odyssey, getting a boat, then to Miami, and then a bus from Miami to Atlanta. They track him down, like patched calls through, and my father hears his voice, "Professor Gladwell, yes. This is, Professor Smith. I invited you to. I have an awkward question." My father says, "Yeah, sure. Fire away." "Professor Gladwell, are you white?" And my father says, "Why, yes." And the other guy goes, "Oh, thank God." At which point my father, the full dimensions of this, the full hilarious and obscene dimensions of this story unfold. So my father puts a giant photograph of my mother in his traveling case, waits till he gets to Georgia Tech, and he's, of course, taken out to dinner as the visiting professor, and all of the luminaries are around the table, so relieved to see that he's pale-skinned. And midway through dinner, he pulls out a picture of my mother, says, "Gentlemen, I'm a newlywed. I'd love you to see a picture of my bride." Watches them. Now, that's an interesting story. I knew my father for 48 years before he told me that story. My point is, it never occurred to me to sit down and ask him questions about, you did marry my mother in 58. It must have been kind of interesting. And I think that everyone has got versions of that, but we just don't understand, because there are stories, we don't understand how great they are. And the one of the simplest tasks of a journalist is just to keep asking questions until you get to those kinds of stories. Sure. And oh, someone right there. Yes, you.
Speaking of newlyweds, I had the privilege of proposing to my future wife last week. And I'm wondering why, in the context of your story, we don't have the same sort of champions of non-heterosexual marriage today that we did 100 years ago and 80 years ago for the suffragette movement, and how big an injustice we'll look upon this 80 to 100 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it is, it has taken us a very, very long time to kind of, I think that barrier is now finally falling. But it's always astonishing how long it takes to kind of bring about some kind of change like this. Right? What's always amazing about all of these stories is, why are we only now on the cusp of getting maybe a female president? Why only now is the tide slowly turning on legalization of gay marriage? I mean, it's just like, it seems like we have these kind of moral insights, but the gap between the moral insight and the practical demonstration of that insight can be decades. And, you know, I guess the task is to try and shrink that gap. It still amazes me. You know, if you look at the list of major countries in the world, we're one of the few now that has never had a female head of state. Kind of astonishing. You know, virtually everyone else, even countries that you wouldn't have thought would have beaten us to the punch. Sure. Right? Yeah.
You've already accomplished such an impressive body of work. I'm curious if there's one particular work that you're most proud of, but also one that you might have structured differently or might need to be updated.
Are you asking me if I have regrets? A few? I'm not going to sing for you if that's what you're thinking. You guys thought I was headed in that direction, didn't you? I'm someone who regrets virtually everything I've ever done. So it's not surprising that I should have regrets about my writing. I think that I haven't read Tipping Point since I wrote it. And I'm scared to. In the same way, so Tipping Point was written in 1998. So let's all think back to what our lives were like in 1998 and ask ourselves, if we were suddenly transported back in time, would we feel comfortable with our choices at that moment? Would you be happy with the way your hair looked in 1998? Or the clothes you wore? Or the color of, you know, the furniture in your living room? There are so many things about 1998 that are deeply embarrassing to me in retrospect that I'm quite sure that were I to reread Tipping Point, I would just wince in pain. So what am I most proud of? The things that you're proudest of course, are the things that, this is true of all of us, all human beings are proudest of the things that other people are not proud of, right, or don't like. You always are drawn to the thing. That question invites you to say, everyone in the world hated this. They didn't understand it's true genius. That's the way you answer that question. So this is true. I have done things that have been universally hated that I have quietly loved. So that's probably the things I'm... And they're always like little, you know, like little limericks that you wrote in for someone's birthday party that fell flat when you delivered them. But you actually thought they were kind of sly and ingenious. It's that kind of thing that I feel most proud of. I'm sure that by the time I'm an old man, I'll look back on my efforts and hang my head. I'm sure that's inevitable, as it is with all of us. Sure, in the front row.
Hi, you talked about the legacy of embitterment a little bit during your talk, and I was wondering how we as a country go about reconciling with those who we may have angered over the years in the international community.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I don't know if you heard it, the question is, if you create anger, leave a residue of anger and illegitimacy, how do you go about correcting that? I tell a story in my book, I'm finally mentioning my book, at sort of hour and 15 minutes into his book talk. Gladwell mentions that he's written a book. I tell a story in David and Goliath about a woman called Joanne Jaffe, who is the head of the housing police in New York City, who asks that, whose job it is to police the housing projects of New York, the worst parts of the city. And ask that exact question. So she gets the job and she says, police are not considered legitimate in the poorest neighborhoods of New York, with good reason. Not because the police force have misbehaved, but because, look, it's really hard if you live in a community where the cops are omnipresent. All you do is see them interacting in a fraught, emotionally and physically fraught way with all the young men in your neighborhood. It's very hard for you to think of that kind of force as legitimate, right? And when, you know, the statistic I cannot get out of my mind is that if you look at the percentage of young black men born in the 1970s who did not graduate from college, so high school dropout, black high school dropout men born in the 1970s, 69% of them have spent some time behind bars. Now, if you're from one of those neighborhoods, there's no way you perceive the law as legitimate. So that's what she said to herself. I am now in charge of those neighborhoods. They don't see me as legitimate. What do I do? And what she did was to embark on a policy of to try and win back their trust. And it was extraordinary. The results, first of all, were incredible, but it took a lot of hard work, and it involved her behaving in ways that police officers do not normally behave. She basically had to go to the families of juvenile delinquents and make friends, knock on the door, introduce herself. She started by bringing them turkeys on Thanksgiving, right? And just said, look, I know you don't trust us, but all I wanted to say is I'm here. I know your kid is, you know, a delinquent. Cops are always coming around and harassing you guys. I'm here to say that I'm on your side. Here's a turkey. That's how it started. She gradually won over the trust of these families, and the crime rate began to fall. Why? Because people realized the law could be on their side. But that took years of hard work, and she had to hire police officers who cared about kids and who could do that, who were good at that thing where you knock on the door and they say, they open the door and they, you know, they say, F you. And they had to be the kind of person you could say, no, I'd like to just like to talk to you and to get to know you. So there's no grand way of doing it. It can only be done in a kind of person-to-person, painstaking way. I put her story in because I think it's such a powerful lesson about, and her accomplishments are so, you look at this decline in crime in those neighborhoods, it's just mind-boggling, really mind-boggling.
I thought so many of the stories in your book were so moving and so inspirational, but there was one chapter about Martin Luther King mm-hmm. that I really had trouble with mm-hmm. because it seemed to me, although I know that all of us respond to what we see on the radio, on the TV, et cetera, and what we have been taught to believe happened, I was so surprised at the way...
Don't give away the surprise. It's a surprise ending. You can't give it away. Spoiler alert. Cover your ears, everyone.
Well, let me say, I was very surprised at what you drew out of Martin Luther King's mm-hmm. experience, and I found it very upsetting.
Yeah. It's supposed to be upsetting. I don't disagree with your reaction. So I'm not going to give away the ending, but I will just say that I tell a story about the civil rights movement in Birmingham. And how did they manage to win against overwhelming odds? And part of the answer is they played a trick. And it's a trick that made people very uncomfortable at the time, that led to widespread criticism along the way of Martin Luther King, and continues to make people uncomfortable today. You and me. I will confess that I also find that a little bit.
My question was, where did you find that slant?
Oh, it's the trick is openly admitted to by Wyatt Walker, Martin Luther King's number two man. So the man who played the trick after it succeeded then was very frank about what he did. I mean, it's no secret. He did many, many, many interviews in the 60s in which he described precisely how they set about to pull the wool over Bull Connor's eyes and the eyes of the press. So it's not a secret or a kind of speculative conclusion. It's what this really remarkable guy called Wyatt Walker, who was sort of King's strategist, stayed in the shadows, brilliant, brilliant guy, and who is the author of this kind of, and you, if those of you who read the book, I'd be very, very curious to know your response, because like I said, I don't disagree with your reaction. I think it's weird what they did. It's weird to think about what they did in the context of, I realize it's now I can't keep talking about this and not tell you, so I'm going to stop. But I'm with you, and I appreciate that response. Last question. How do I choose? In the back, the person most vociferously. Yes, the glasses, blonde hair, and green. How's that?
Well, as perhaps the only sacrilegious Jew who's attending on a Friday night, I have to ask this question, which is, how much do you think religious upbringing plays into this? Because I will say every Reform conservative Jew is brought up to challenge God, do everything, challenge authority, versus my Catholic friends who were accepting of authority. And I'm wondering, you haven't mentioned the religious factor yet, and I'm wondering if it's significant at all in your
Well, the last third of my book is all about religious faith. The last two chapters in particular, but also the civil rights chapter is about the consequences, in part, the consequences of deep religious commitment, what that gives you. And then the last two chapters are all about extraordinary things that faith makes possible. I think it's... I ended on that note because I came to understand and appreciate in writing the book that the most significant weapon in the arsenal of underdogs are, though, as they that lovely phrase, are the weapons of the spirit. The power you get from your belief in God. And at the end of the day, nothing can beat that. And I tell a story about a woman who, on the strength of her faith, forgives the murderer of her daughter. And the last story of the book is about a village up in the mountains of France, a Protestant village that openly takes in Jews during the Second World War in complete defiance of the Nazis. And there's no mystery about why. Here are two sets of people who have no external material advantage. They have no formal power. They got no money. They got nothing. But what they have is something in their heart that says, I am empowered by God to do the right thing. And that's enough. And it's very both uplifting and also kind of I was very writing this book moved me in a way that writing my previous books did not, for that very fact that I just was by the end to sit in the backyard of a little bungalow in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and talked to a woman whose daughter was murdered brutally by a sexual predator and who stood up on the day that her tortured daughter's body was found, stood up in front of a press conference of 100 people, you know, waving microphones in her face and said, without even knowing who her daughter's murderer was, whoever he is, I am on the path to forgiving him. You know, that was, to hear her say that is just the most, it floored me then and it floors me still. And you cannot but have awe for the power of that kind of thing if you hear it firsthand. But anyway, thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.